The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am honored to welcome our guest this evening. Honored is a word that gets used a bit too freely these days, but tonight it's entirely apt. Esteemed historian David Levering Lewis has twice won the Pulitzer Prize for his superb two-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, the polymath founder of the NAACP and a principal shaper of the civil rights movement. His other books include God's Crucible, Race to Fashoda, and King, notable for being the first scholarly biography of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. Lewis's awards include the highest honors for writing on history, including the Bancroft Prize, the Francis Parkman Prize, along with the National Humanities Medal. His latest book is a biography of Wendell Willkie, the unlikely nominee and progressive Republican presidential candidate who believed in the need to regulate the force of free enterprise, espoused collective bargaining for labor, federal regulation of interstate utilities, security markets, and banking, and was the first leader to address the annual convention of the NAACP. As we'll also learn, though looking around, I expect many of you already know, Philadelphia played a prominent role in his trajectory on the world stage, which makes it all the more appropriate that our guest will be in conversation with Sam Katz, civic entrepreneur and executive producer of History Making Productions. Please join me in welcoming back David Levering Lewis and Sam Katz.
Thank you, Andy. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. David, welcome.
It's good to be here.
David's from New York. We checked his passport just north of here and let him in.
I'm not an immigrant, though.
Like the rest of us. So having followed your career and read one of your prior books, I'm curious what transpired in your mind to take you from Africa, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, to the vanquished Republican candidate for president in 1940?
Yes. I've been asking myself why I'm the author of this biography. I do remember two things. One, that I was 4 years old when Willkie was running the first time for the presidency, and my father was a Willkie Republican, and my mother was a Roosevelt Democrat. And although I didn't quite understand the issues, I do recall the volume of the exchange. I always found that a curious thing as I went on to do other things. Along the way, though, I was writing a book about the jazz age in America, and in a drawer in the Adams Building, I came across a letter from Wendell Willkie to Walter White, who was the longtime head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And that letter came soon after his primary failure in Wisconsin and his virtual ostracism from the Republican Party. And he said in that letter that he had not enjoyed himself as much in the party that Walter had given him, that the congregation of men and women there was so sympathetic and so aware. He said, "People think that I'm depressed. I'm not. And your appreciation of what I've tried to mean will buoy me, and I'm going forward. Of course, he didn't go far forward after that point. And so that registered, and I think after a 15-year production of a two-volume biography of Du Bois, I wanted something else to do. And I thought of Wendell Willkie, and here we are.
And I can tell you from having read this book, which I really recommend, that the quality and depth of the research was really impressive. And I'm curious, what were the nature, just because of my own interest in history and my limited experience doing original research, primary research, what kinds of collections and resources did you need to tap into and were able to tap into in order to construct this narrative?
Well, happily, Willkie's papers are at the Lilly Library at the University of Indiana, Bloomington. It's a vast collection. How does it compare to the Du Bois correspondence? Well, it's probably about a fourth the size of that. And Du Bois lived 95 years lucidly, writing every day, so you get some idea of the number of boxes there at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. There at the Lilly Library are the notebooks, the correspondence, the photographs of this man's life. And so comprehensive as it is, you might say you could, the collection would suffice to write the book. However, because he was so multifaceted, I wanted context. And so I reached out to Willkieites and Willkieite descendants, and I was gratified to find that so many octogenarians like myself and nonagenarians remembered Willkie, and so the oral history for the book was pretty adequate, I should think. But of course, because his life involved so many other lives, there were other biographies to read and other collections, and so Princeton, with the David Lilienthal collection, was indispensable, and Yale, the Walter Lippmann papers, indispensable. And so you could multiply that. Mind you, I didn't go to all of these places. I had a brilliant research assistant, a young PhD, who now is getting his PhD in economics, and I needed no more than to tell him what I wanted, then he would go and pretty well do it and come back and say, but Professor Lewis, you really need it more because I found this and that. And I'd say, well, go back and do so. So the research for the book was pretty ample. And in a way, it slowed down the production timetable, getting those notes right. But if that had not been the case, the book would have come out much sooner. And I think I have to say that, as I was saying to you earlier, I'm going to send an inscribed copy of my book to Donald Trump.
And I'm sure when the Trump Library opens many years from now, if you bring a thumb drive, you'll be able to collect all of his papers. So how many people in this audience can remember voting for Wendell Willkie? Okay, I didn't think there would be any. David, why should we care about Willkie? What is Willkie's importance to our understanding of our politics, of what was once the Republican Party, and of the history of isolationism versus global engagement?
Yes. I suppose we know that Wendell Willkie was a Democrat, descended from a family of passionate silver dollar William Jennings Bryan advocates. He was told by Harvey Firestone when he became chief of his legal department in Akron, Ohio, Harvey said to him, you know, as smart as you are, it's too bad you'll never amount to anything because you are a Democrat. He was a passionate Democrat, and from Akron, Ohio, he went to the memorable 1924 convention. He was quite active in supporting the man who was the heir of the infirm and recently deceased, it was then, Woodrow Wilson. For Wilkie, the League of Nations was his religion, he said, and that this country had dropped the ball on its affiliation with a grand design for a parliament of man, as it were, was a reproach that he carried with him and that animated him in his politics. Well, in 1933, the new administration of Franklin Roosevelt in its 100 days created an institution that ran thwart across the interests of Wendell Wilkie. He had, because of his lawyering and his diligence and initiative, been recognized by a mysterious utilities man who had created, had combined some 160 utility companies into one. It became known as Commonwealth and Southern, and it lit up to some degree the South and much of the North. And when the Tennessee Valley Authority was created, without any interaction with or concern for or promise to Wendell Wilkie's Commonwealth and Southern, he bridled. He went before Congress. He said that the interruption or the insertion of government money into the private market was unfair and indeed a terrible precedent. the opposition to TVA by Wendell began an opposition to the New Deal that was perhaps the most fierce and eventually perhaps the most colorful. As year by year, Wilkie marched to the Supreme Court to challenge on one ground or another TVA. Always overruled, but curiously, the court never decided on the constitutionality of the TVA. It rather denied the standing of the parties. In his opposition, he created a great deal of publicity, and the first newsreels are just coming along. Those Pathé newsreels that we all went to weekends, and soon there was a very jolly, large Wendell Wilkie saying in his gravel voice that he had created a great utility concern and he had been fair to his customers and he was being robbed of his profits by a leviathan that depended on the taxes of the citizenry and not the market operation of the market to determine how electricity should be sold. finally, he came to the attention of the Loose Empire, and a number of dinners occurred in which both Clare and Henry found this man charismatic, sharp as a tack, and perhaps someone who might speak for the issues of the Looses, and especially for the Republican Party. And so that began. I should add that geographically, of course, we've come a long way because Wendell was born in Elwood, Ohio, a Hoosier.
Elwood, Indiana.
Did I say Ohio?
Yes, you did.
Indiana. was a bit rough-hewn and bore the kind of simplicity of the cornfield, perhaps. But along the way, running Commonwealth and Southern, he met an extraordinary woman Irita Van Doren, who was the literary editor of the Herald Tribune. And there was an electricity which was extraordinary and to be enduring. Wilkie was married to a very fine woman, and she bore up, I suppose, an affair that really became permanent and bigamous. But the point is that she taught Wendell in various East Side dinners how to frame his issues, and indeed how to become a bit of a prose man. It's interesting that Wendell reviewed two books for the Herald Tribune. They are books that would have been rather challenging, you would have thought, one by a British duke, and yet they are so mellifluous in their prose and so insightful, just remarkable. So we can take those reviews as markers of his ongoing sophistication. Of course, this is to say as well that Irita Van Doren became his muse quite profoundly. So the combination of the Lewises, the Luces, and Irita Van Doren made him then the voice of the business community that had been intimidated and rightly so critiqued for being responsible for so much, because Wendell had a way of talking about the New Deal and reproaching its bureaucracy and warning its citizens, warning the citizenry of the ongoing imperial presidency of Roosevelt, but at the same time saying that the business community can save the country if indeed there could be a dialogue between government and business. And he framed the arguments that today would seem self-evident, Chamber of Commerce boilerplate, but they were new in his articulation. And so in 1939, there was a constituency in the Republican Party of internationalists, and fair to say of the WASP leadership of the Eastern Seaboard, concerned about the rampage of fascism and what that would, what that portended, but unable really to persuade the bulk of its own party that its non-interventionism or its isolationism or its nationalism was wrong-headed historically. Wilkie, they soon perceived to be the man who could do this. And so, quite suddenly, the Democrat is no longer a Democrat, and within 6 months of the famous Philadelphia Convention of 1940, he had switched parties. And I suppose you might empathize somewhat, as I believe your own political career has been one of varied political affiliations.
Well, mine was not as successful as Wendell Wilkie's.
Well, he was not successful either. He did not win, as we know. The chapter on which is called The Philadelphia Story is somewhat derivative, because Peters, in 5 days in Philadelphia, recreated those days quite memorably. And a very fine journalist named Sam Neill also. I add a bit more to it because, in fact, the mechanics of the convention and how Wilkie prevailed, I think I have uncovered rather more clearly than has been in the past. Just an example, a very successful Republican named Sam Pryor, who became vice president of Pan American Airways, was the vice chair of the convention arrangements or the arrangements committee. The man who was chair of the arrangements committee and who had successfully in two conventions performed and seemed to be in quite good health dropped dead of a cardiac just a few days before the convention convened, and that meant that the keys of the convention were in the hands of Sam Pryor. Sam Pryor was in collaboration with a young man named Orrin Root, who was the grandnephew of Elihu Root, the secretary both of Army and State under McKinley and Roosevelt. And rather proudly, that patrician young man wrote a manifesto from his desk at Davis Polk, a white shoe law firm, and he sent out the manifesto to all the graduates of the Ivy League, asking them to multiply the manifestos, and in no time at all, tens of thousands of Ivy League graduates and their supervisors had rallied to become part of the Orrin Root Boys for Wendell Willkie. And it was they who occupied the galleries here in Philadelphia on a ratio of 10-1, because Sam Pryor made sure that the tickets went out in that ratio. Gore Vidal, who was in the audience in the convention, he was then 17. This is his first convention, and he writes about this, and he says, it's the first time ever that the galleries have determined what the floor does, because they shouted stentorianly, Willkie, 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 and Willkie prevailed. Hoover, though, was still very much alive, and Hoover had prepared, they said, those who had seen the composition, an extraordinary document which would perhaps stampede the convention in his behalf. Remember that many Republicans thought that it was Roosevelt who had made Hoover's job so difficult in refusing at all to help during the transition. He was very much loved. And as the lights went up, Hoover walked the nave of the convention to give his speech, and he gave it. But oddly enough, the convention began to susurrus and talk and what have you, because the audio had been turned off by Sam Pryor. So on the fifth day, we have Wendell Willkie as the standard bearer of the Republican Party. It's a close run. It is the most successful Republican performance until Dwight Eisenhower. Roosevelt refused to meet him in a Stephen Douglas kind of scenario, which poor Willkie thought, new to politics, was the obligation of politicians. Roosevelt said, I was much too busy, you know, moving about the country and inspecting this and that. Eleanor Roosevelt finally said, Franklin, if you don't go out, you're going to lose. And indeed he did, and he agreed to make three speeches, the outcome we know. However, there is another aspect that I think is a discovery of my own. It was that, as we know, so many Americans were not, after having tried in World War I to help their European cousins, at all interested in a second go, especially the Irish, who had no particular love for Great Britain and thought maybe the Germans were doing a good job. And there were the Italians, because Italian fascism at that point also inspired them. And then there were others who thought simply that one war was enough. In particular was, of course, our ambassador to the Court of St. James's, Mr. Kennedy, Joseph Kennedy. And Willkie had been told by Clara Booth Luce, who had become very close to Joseph Kennedy, that Kennedy was going to leave his ambassadorial post and come to the airport and endorse Wilkie. And the assumption was that the Irish vote then would make the difference. And that expectation was absolutely plausible. It did not happen. By the time Kennedy reached Idlewild, he had his Boeing seaplane had been intercepted with communiques asking that he rush to the White House. And years later, we found out that with Lyndon Johnson there in the Oval Office as Kennedy is speaking to FDR, FDR draws his finger across his throat as he invites the Kennedys to come to dinner the next evening. And so Joe Kennedy brilliantly endorsed FDR in Boston just before FDR spoke, and so that was rather decisive.
Was the finger across the throat message to Joe Kennedy?
Well, there were three ways to read that. Either that Kennedy was going to end up charged with treason because MI5 had listened to everything that Kennedy had said, and some of the things he said were rather as puzzlingly disloyal as some of the things our president seems to say about Mr. Putin. So there was that element. The other was that the force of the government would cost the Kennedys much in terms of tax and, investigations, no doubt. And the other was that the deal would have been to endorse the young Kennedy for a major position. In any case, it really wouldn't have mattered if the Irish vote had given Wilkie the presidency, because as we know from the archive that is slowly being opened in Great Britain about British intelligence during World War II in the United States, the British ambassador, Lord Lothian, communicated to his government to say that this is a theater and it, let's take it seriously, but it will not matter whether Roosevelt loses and Wilkie wins or vice versa, because Mr. Wilkie has said to me that slowly but surely he will work on his party so that its internationalism does not interfere or preclude the kind of solidarity when Nazism is opposed. And I think that's true. I think Wilkie was an internationalist. Wilkie was a visionary. And his party would have, with Joe Martin's assistance, I think, come to heel, as in fact it did.
One of the parts of your book that it wasn't a big part, but it did catch my attention, was what you called the invisible empire of the Ku Klux Klan, and how post the production and distribution of Birth of a Nation, we saw this massive uprising of white supremacy. I wonder if you could, and also anti-immigration and isolationism, these three things seem to be pretty much in the air. Can you give us a little context of what was happening and maybe bring it to contemporary terms?
I suppose it would be good to start with the 1924 Democrat Convention in New York, which has gone down in history described as the Klan Bake Convention. At that moment, America was undergoing, immigrant America was undergoing a xenophobic frisson as more and more people came to the country who were deemed by others to be less suited for absorption, people from Southern Europe and elsewhere, people who were Catholic or people whose faiths were different and so on. And of course, it is just as that convention is meeting, Ellis Island is shuttered and will be shuttered forever in the Johnson Reed Immigration Act. And the convention reflected that in that meeting in New York, Al Smith presiding over his legions, and meeting in New York, Mr. McAdoo, Woodrow Wilson's son-in-law, presiding over the nativists. And it was a terrible convention in which they battled over issues of religion and drink and of citizenship. The Klan at that point was perhaps the most effective organized body going. It had, in its second incarceration, the first, of course, had been at the end of the Civil War, but the one that sprang into action as a result of the famous movie, Birth of a Nation, minded itself in terms of not being openly violent, but its influence in terms of institutions, school boards, and the Democrat Party was quite considerable. I might just add that from that convention of 1924, Wendell Willkie returned to Akron, Ohio, and contested the vote for the Akron School Board. It was assumed that the Klan would sweep to victory there. Because of Wendell's opposition, it did not. So the country of immigration, as today, became a country some of whose immigrants, having some generational sojourn here, had a point of view that said enough, no more, that it's a zero-sum situation. Their coming here means less for us. That was not true then. That is not true now. But as we find in the views of the Republican Party today, those issues were there waiting once again to inform one of our parties. The campaign for the presidency, the Willkie was able to close the gap quite quickly by charging that Roosevelt was a warmonger, and within the final days of the campaign, until Roosevelt expressly said that your boys will never ever be sent abroad, which of course they soon were, defeated the spurt that he had made. But now, with the defeat of Willkie, came something quite extraordinary. And that was on Armistice Day, a few days after the victory of Roosevelt, he went on the three networks and he spoke to an audience larger than the audience that had assembled for Franklin Roosevelt's famous speech. Said that his party must be a party of collaboration, not a party of opposition simply for its own sake, that the concept of the loyal opposition was a concept that he would abide and express. And that term and the speech, indeed, interjected a new transactional, collaborative, position, still oppositional, that was to be quite welcome, and for many years, indeed, after Wilkie's departure, was a kind of bedrock for the two-party system.
After the 1940 election, the relationship between Roosevelt, who would live for another 4 years, and Wilkie, at least publicly, seemed to be aligned. How did that happen? And what does it say about these two guys that they could become useful to each other?
That it is really quite remarkable to watch. The three issues that immediately were in the forefront after the 1940 Roosevelt victory were, one, a peacetime military draft, which had never been done, and Wilkie assented that Republican opposition would be moderated on that issue. And the next was, of course, Lend-Lease, which Wilkie formally endorsed, and endorsed it rather compellingly because he went off to England in the midst of the Blitz to inform himself firsthand how the British were holding up and whether they were a good risk, indeed, and returned and spoke to the Foreign Affairs Committee, Senate Committee, and the largest audience, I think, on Capitol Hill, and prevailed his endorsement of Lend-Lease, his argument that the best way not to be involved in a war is to make sure that our supporters survive, did prevail. And then the momentum of that carries on, with, mind you, quite a bit of acerbity. Wilkie is not happy after Pearl Harbor that the organization of the of industry is as smartly done, and gives Roosevelt a lot of thumps there publicly. But at a quite dramatic point, soon after the war is really underway, he volunteers his services to circumnavigate the globe and parachute into all the theaters of combat, and does this leaving in August and will return in October, having flown 31,000 miles in a B-25, the first ever circumnavigation, and bringing the principles of the Atlantic Charter and the commitment of the United States not to territory, not to supporting a continued empires, but a democratic world if we all pull together. And so we have him telling de Gaulle in Syria that Syria does not belong to France. And de Gaulle, of course, is unpersuaded, and that will haunt the peace. Churchill famously retorting when Wilkie said in China that this war is being fought to bring about the end of all empires, all European empires, and it's to responding to that Churchill famously said that he had not become His Majesty's first minister to preside over the demise of the British Empire. The dealings with Stalin were fascinating as well. As the guest of the great dictator, argues vociferously the merits of the market economy to every Russian he meets, with Joe Barnes, the very capable Herald Tribune journalist and fluent in Russian, apologizing to the Russians and saying, well, you know, he's just a hardy guy, so don't take it personally when he tells you that you really need to have more freedom from your government. Stalin, the reaction, the interaction with Stalin is a classic one. It's cinematic. Stalin has just learned that there will not be a second front, as Roosevelt had promised Stalin. And this is news to Wendell, who's been sent around the world to garner support for the United Nations and to embrace the charter, the Atlantic Charter, and all that sort of thing, and to find that that he too thought that there was to be a second front that was not to happen, results in his daring to say that this is a mistake, which of course lands like bombs in Ottawa and London and Washington, but reflected the man's independence and determination to be a square shooter. The reaction of Stalin to Wilkie's position about Poland was also interesting. Stalin agreed that there would be some margin of maneuver in the liberated Poland, and indeed did up to a point after after Yalta honor that, but only up to a point, which is to say that the war is reaching its term in 1944, Wendell Willkie had the experience of meeting all the players who would be present, the persona dramatis of the peacetime, Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, who, as it turns out, developed a special intimacy with Wendell, both in Chengdu and in Washington, and of course Stalin, and indeed quite the ensemble of the leaders to come after the war ends. And that experience and that knowledge, it seems to me, would have been invaluable in the first years of the peace, as a vice president succeeds Roosevelt, who is totally innocent of any of the negotiations or the temperament of diplomacy that Roosevelt and Wilkie had presided over.
Before we turn it over to the audience for questions, the Wendell Wilkie that you thought would be an interesting fellow to meet as you started this project versus the Wendell Wilkie that you got to know through the years of researching and writing this project differed how?
In terms of growth, to be sure, in terms of opportunity, which befell him, so that as he filled out himself, his leverage in various ways was important. Certainly, his role in promoting the United Nations was almost existential. But I think what is remarkable about him is that partisanship for him was so tertiary, so secondary, that he naturally had to be misunderstood. For him, it was the service to the nation and the service beyond the nation to the world that this nation has helped create, that those things supervened the narrowness of politics. And so one can understand how the old guard Republicans had no patience, the Pews and the DuPonts and the Keeneys and others, with his kind of politics. But I think that his instincts were right. And when it came to civil rights civil rights and civil liberties, he was extraordinary. There is still on the books a Supreme Court decision, Schneiderman versus the United States. And that case was argued by Wilkie in person, in which policy of nullifying citizenship on the basis of presumed ideas of disloyalty was forever ended. That is to say, the case law is that you cannot have your citizenship removed because you've been a rather unpleasant person and have even said some rather disloyal things. And this was the Wilkie decision, the Wilkie case, which I think is quite quite admirable. Also, he was a civil rights man in advance of perhaps even rather recent political figures. About to run again in 1944, he announced that there would be an African American either on the Supreme Court or in his cabinet. He, in that interesting friendship with Walter White, which developed after he lost the first time, resulted in his addressing from the NAACP National Convention in Los Angeles to the nation on radio an appeal for an Atlantic Charter of Race Relations, an appeal that eloquently pointed out the hypocrisy of and the disjunction between fighting for democracy here but not there. So he's a well-rounded persona, I think. Finally, his impact on the sophistication of his people is also of great credit. What I have in mind is the book he wrote about his circumnavigation of the globe. That book appeared in 1943, early. It was called One World. And One World sold more copies than any other book in the United States in the 20th century. It sold 2 million copies in the first week of its appearance. And although today it's a thin book, and if you were to peruse it, you'd say it's sort of hackneyed here, it's cardboard figures there, oh shucks, well, isn't that something we all know? But if you can imagine the impact in situ of that book, it in fact had such an impact that it was a marker in the beginning of the end of American innocence. It announced to Americans that the role played now that was coming to an end victoriously offered to this country, with its exceptionalist paradigm, the opportunity to make the world not in an imitation of itself, but in a reflection or absorption of its ideals. The book One World, like, I think you would say, the small essay by Henry Wallace, The Century of the Common Man, both reflected two citizens who were sensitive to the opportunities and the dangers of winning World War II. And with Wilkie, the education of his citizens was, though, of course, not the education of his party, because by that time, Clara Booth Luce had a new term for a man she once admired, that she and her group were tired of the globaloney, of Wendell Willkie. She had called him the Abraham Lincoln of the cosmos when the book came out, but she soon changed her mind.
So, any questions?
Thank you. Is there any vestige of Wendell Willkie in today's Republican Party?
You mean besides you?
There may be faint echoes. I was interested to see that when a Democrat from Georgia who became a Republican, Zell Miller, if that name rings a bell, when he passed, two presidents honored him, Bill Clinton and the second Bush. And the second Bush surprised me by saying that this man reflected those ideas and those political principles which the great Wendell Willkie exemplified. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. And it is interesting because I am to go off to lead the presidential symposium in SMU, Southern Methodist University, where, of course, the second Bush's papers are. And I assume that there may have been some goodness of fit because of George Bush's admiration for Wendell Willkie. However, admiring Wendell Willkie is one thing, but to destabilize the world on the basis of a fraudulent assumption is, of course, another. But here we are.
I think that Wendell Willkie is the only nominee of a major party who ever achieved that role without having been a high political person or a general. Looking at the current crop of business and political leaders, is there anybody out there who you could think of who might manage to storm a convention and become a nominee of a major party?
I was with Louis Laffan the other evening, and he said, you know, these are dark days. But the only thing that could happen is that the Democrats get some Republican to lead them. That was gallows humor, perhaps. I don't see anyone of that ilk. You have faint murmurs. You have a Mr. Flake, for example, whose views of his own party are pained, I gather. You have Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who has a kind of Willkie-esque patina. But I think the answer is sadly no. And it's but your question is existential, because ours is a presidential, it is an imperial regime. Just as with the Romans, we have to have someone who represents us in the body. A kind of collective government or a congressional, and there have been times when Congress, of course, ruled, but it doesn't work. We must have someone who is the decider, as Bush used to say, and I don't see anyone who will be able to do that. If the Republic survives, we can see that there's a new population of people running for office, more women than ever before, and more people who are called social democrats or socialists, that is to say people who think that there should be health care for everybody, and people who say that tuitions are killing them, and so, you know, we should have some taxes there. But they're not going to prevail in November, but they signal a direction that we want to keep going. But I think that, and I was just reading David Frum's piece in The Atlantic, And it is really dystopian in its prediction. And it is that it's very likely that the Weimar experience is staring us in our faces. Every single institution that we thought was a break on autocracy and insanity has not performed. Now the court is to become an adjunct of the Chamber of Commerce. So it does look like we may well have a man who doesn't have an ideology, but nonetheless whose staying power and destruction of all of the things that protect the citizenry are sent caterwauling out of the door is going to be with us for some time.
So I'm not going to call on somebody before I have an answer to your question because I feel compelled to. I think you were asking about whether a business person or some non-political person could emerge in either party's process, and I would agree with David, that is not going to happen in the next cycle. The question really, in my mind, is whether the Democratic Party is prepared to compromise with itself to nominate somebody who can win, as opposed to somebody who adheres to a point of view, whatever that point of view might be, wherever it is on the spectrum. And if they do, if you really go back and look at the math of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Michigan, the extent to which you have to move white working class voters who are economic voters, not cultural voters, not white supremacy voters, but economic voters, is not a big number. And if we relitigate the Obama administration in this campaign, we're not going to be in a good place. So we need a break from the past, in my opinion, and we need to nominate a radical centrist. And the Democratic Party is not on a good course that way, but I believe it will get there. And I believe Donald Trump will be defeated in 2020. Well, Jamie Dimon and Bloomberg. Bloomberg is not exactly a non-politician. He spent 12 years as mayor. And Jamie Dimon, you know, no one knows, you know, there's such a thing called candidate skills. And very few people who run large corporations have them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that a radical centrist is an artful term and prior. But I think it's really impossible.
It may be impossible to be nominated as a radical centrist, but it's the only candidate who will beat Trump.
Well,
we can debate that afterwards. By the way, I do want to tell you, when we do go upstairs, you should buy this book. You will be stunned by how much you don't know about our country in the 20th century. I just could not get over how much connectivity David was able to bring to a not contemporary story, but a story that is not so far in our past that even our memories or our studies could take us there and make us understand so much more about our country today. Yes, sir. With the Chicago Cubs hat, is that?
No, I'm a Phillies fan, Sam.
Okay.
It's a Cleveland Indians hat. Somebody told me this is Stanford conspiracy. Mr. Lewis, you had made the comment that MI5 was opened up its archives regarding the surveillance of our politics prior to 1940.
Mm-hmm. During.
Okay. Did you get a chance to surveil on
it? Some of it has leaked, but the statute of limitations has been extended. That is to say, the document should have been available in this decade, and they will not be available until 2040 at Churchill College.
One more question. Jim?
Thank you. What has to happen to make Congress functional again?
What has to happen to make Congress function again?
Well, it's wishful thinking, but if we could and it's not going to be possible as the court fulfills the dream of the Federalist Society in Lewis Powell's famous memorandum. That is the reversal of Citizens United. I mean, the Republic cannot go on. We can either say that Kochs are not so bad, or this group, or even Bloomberg is not so bad, or what have you. But the idea that money is in fact is an adamant participant in the decision making of the Republic is obscene and devastating. How can you run for office if you've got to run out the day after you've been elected and sup at the teat of lobbyists and of corporations and what have you? And we are unique in that regard. Money plays a part elsewhere, to be sure. But no country has given itself a constitution and a Supreme Court that disables it.
David, thank you for being in Philadelphia.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Hopefully you will not all be watching television all day tomorrow. Have a good night, Andy. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.